Thanks for joining us today on the Larry Mueller Show for our regular home improvement show. I'm Jill Nadeau. John Freiberger is back. He's a registered home inspector with more than 50 years of experience, and he specializes in energy design and restoring older homes, among other things. We're going to talk about dealing with water in your basement and, of course, take your questions. Have you noticed excess moisture in your home? Do you have mold in your attic or your basement? Well, give us a call. We can help. 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. John, it's so good to see you again.
Good to see you and be back again.
Well, we've had a lot of water.
Yes, we have.
And a lot of it's ended up in the basement. Mm-hmm. So what should we be doing about that?
Well, water gets to be a complicated issue because water is all dependent upon drainage, isn't it?
Yes.
And we can see some drainage, but there's a lot of drainage we can't see. So we can see what's coming off our roof into the gutters. We can see when it comes out of the downspouts. Assuming we have gutters and downspouts, we can see it washing down the driveway. But what the heck is going on underground?
That's a trick question.
Right. It's extremely tricky. And sometimes until you actually take out a shovel, you don't know. So we can manage what we can. And if we're going to manage drainage, we're going to manage the obvious and cheapest first. So you're getting water in your basement. Do you have gutters on your house? If you don't, well, and then how big are your gutters? Because I have a lot of people calling me now, and they've got a house that's 45, 50, 60 feet long, and they got a little 5-inch gutter with a downspout at one end. Well, it fills up with water, and you know they've got Niagara Falls coming out of the gutter.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we need to get the roof drainage under control. And then somebody calls, you have water in the basement, and they've got plenty of nice gutters, and then they're dumping all the water 2 feet away from the basement. So they're consolidating high volumes of water next to their foundation, and then they're surprised when it leaks. So we need to transport that water away from the foundation. The Uniform Dwelling Code in Wisconsin knows all this. And when you build a new house, the building inspector is supposed to check to make sure that you've got 5 inches of drop in the first 10 feet around your house. A lot of times it doesn't happen. But the half inch per foot pitch is a pretty good idea. When you get to things like driveways, it can be much less, or sidewalks, because you don't have all this friction, but we've got the mulch around the house, we've got the washstone, we've got the grass we forgot to cut that's now 4 inches long, and all of that is going to slow that water down so it goes into the soil and starts surcharging the moisture in the soil. That then is going to spread out in all directions. And if your basement wall is in that cone, basically, of water, that water is going to find its way in because it's literally under some pressure. I mean, we talk about hydrostatic head pressure. So you got an 8-foot deep basement and it's leaking down the footings. Well, we may have a pretty good column of water that's actually pushing there. So it's not just gravity flow, it's actually pressure, right? So then we get into more complicated things. So we've done it what we can on the outside. We extended the downspouts. We got the right gutters. We put in the drainage, and we're still getting water. So that probably means that the water table in your yard or in your entire neighborhood is actually higher than your basement floor.
What can you do about that, John?
Well, if I'm building you a new house, I can build one that you could drop in the middle of Lake Mendota and it would float and never leak. But I know you have a 102-year-old house. So we have to break up that pressure and we have to try to collect that water. So there are a lot of basement retrofit companies out of there because there's a lot of basements that needed to be retrofitted. And basically what we're looking at is coming in with a concrete saw, cutting a foot to 18 inches all the way around the basement, and then putting in drain tile, wash stone, one or two sump pits. I really like two sump pits. Pumps always fail, and they fail during the wettest possible weather. So then you have two ways of getting water out of the basement. So you're breaking up the pressure. You might still get a few little leaks through the wall, but they have these nice little dimple board and corrugated things that they can put against the wall so the water comes through the wall through, let's say, a snap tie or a little pebble hole, runs down the wall, and it still goes into the drain tile instead of on the floor. And this is, there are franchises out there. There are all kinds of different companies that have now been doing this for 30, 40, 50 years. And a lot of them actually know what they're doing and will do a good job for you. Mm-hmm. And some of them will give you some pretty nice guarantees. And, of course, whenever you do something expensive, you want to ask, what's the guarantee? What's the warranty?
Sure. So what about those people out there who have these beautifully finished basements and they're getting some leaks? Where do they go?
Well, we have actually dug up houses and put a water barrier and a water collection system against the outside because it was the only thing you could really do. The basement could have a 10-foot ceiling. They could have big egress windows, or maybe it's open on the backside so you can actually walk out to a nice patio, but the front side's leaking or the sides are leaking. So in some cases, the only way you can really stop it is to dig it up. And a lot of these new houses, unfortunately, have drainage systems, but they weren't put in very well. Some contractors believe that water runs uphill. So you dig up the drain tile, and the water is not going into the sump pit. It's still going into the basement. The drain tile just becomes a water collection, but not a discharge.
Sure.
This is horribly expensive. But if somebody's got $100,000 worth of improvements in their basement, spending $25,000 digging it up and waterproofing does work.
Mm-hmm.
There is another way you can do it. I don't like it as well, but we do have systems that we can put against the inside of your foundation wall. And again, it's like a dimple board or a corrugated material. It's always some sort of plastic, PCV or something like that. So when the water comes through the wall, it hits the airspace, it drains down to the bottom, and at the bottom we make sure it goes into the drain tile.
Mm-hmm.
So one can retrofit a basement that way, but it means taking out the drywall, the studs, and redoing all of that.
Sure.
But it's going to be less expensive than it is to dig up the outside of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always a cure. Not a cheap cure.
Heaven forbid.
But there is a cure.
Sure, sure. So if we do have a basement and we're interested in refinishing it, do you have suggestions on who should come in to inspect that to make sure that what we're doing is going to, you know, number one, we don't have leaks, and then what we're putting mm-hmm. in is a good fit?
Well, I think you've got two choices. One would be a basement specialist, one of the people who retrofits. And you hire them to come and look and see if they see any problems, because that's what they're trained to look for.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing would be a Wisconsin registered home inspector. And hopefully you find someone who says, I've got a specialty in basements. The question is, do you have a concrete basement poured? Do you have a concrete block basement? Do you have an old stone foundation like my house? Do you have a brick foundation or something weird and combination of them? Sometimes the basement guys, they're used to poured concrete, and they're sort of used to concrete block, but we're getting into the weird stuff. Sometimes you need a home inspector who specializes in old houses or in water issues.
Mm-hmm.
So you may have to make a few phone calls, do a little bit of interviewing, but find somebody who can really tell you what's going on.
Okay.
Then you need to not use all kinds of things in your basement.
Like?
Drywall.
Yeah.
You want to grow mushrooms? Drywall is great. All you have to do is get it wet.
There's a market. Mm-hmm. Not for those, though.
Yeah, you can grow as much green penicillium as you want on any sheet of drywall. So let's use something like a fiberglass board, which is a calcium carbonate and fiberglass. It sort of looks like drywall, but it has no cellulose. You could put it in a barrel of water and nothing would ever grow on it because there's nothing to eat.
Is that what we would use in our bathroom?
We should.
Okay.
But we don't. There's this other thing out there that I think they call blue board or green
yes.
board,
mm-hmm.
which is made of cellulose and it's treated to resist moisture.
Okay.
Yeah, it will resist it for minutes, sometimes even hours.
You're so encouraging, John.
So let's go with something that really works.
Okay.
The other thing that I do in basements is I use a lot of metal studs because a wood stud has cellulose, it's got carbon, it can grow things. And then we want to make sure we have a good airspace between the outside wall, and we need to be able to circulate some air in there because even if your basement isn't leaking, your basement's leaking. It's not liquid water, but it's water vapor because concrete is porous and it is permeable. So we need to be able to have some kind of air changes so that the moisture and humidity that's coming through that wall can be evacuated and replaced with inside air. I tell people never put carpet on a concrete floor in a basement. Now, on a new house, you are supposed to have a layer of visqueen, of plastic, clear plastic, usually 6 mil, 8 mil underneath your floor. And so they lay that down, and then they walk all over it. And it's laid over sharp gravel. So by the time they pour the concrete, basically they've got cheesecloth.
Yes.
Now, you can put in membranes and things to make a floor really, really dry. But unless you do that, I tell people, take a look at tile for your basement. And nowadays, besides ceramic tile, we have LVT, luxury vinyl tile. And the snap-together stuff is actually pretty good. Because let's say we got a crack in the floor and we get a little leak in there, we can actually unsnap that tile and find it, not like carpet.
Right. Yeah, and there's nothing worse than trying to pull out wet carpet.
It's very heavy.
Oh, goodness gracious. So, we are talking with John Freiberger today. If you have any questions for him on, well, we're talking about water in a basement, but obviously he can answer pretty much anything else. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. Coming up at 12:30 today, we're going to be talking about water again, but the good kind, the boating kind. We'll get an update about boater safety from our friends at the DNR. But now it's time to turn ourselves back to home improvement. So we talked a little bit about water coming in, and you talked about the drywall. If we get water in the basement, we have drywall, we got to get it out of there, don't we?
That is correct. And again, we have a profession that has grown up where people have really learned from past mistakes and nowadays are often quite competent.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have mold remediation companies out there. Some of them are franchises, and there's nothing wrong with franchises as long as they train. And we also have labs that'll come in and simply do mold testing for you. You want to know how bad it is. And often I suggest they start I have people in town that I've worked with for years and years, and I have them come in and evaluate the situation, do the air tests, find out the type of molds we have, and then that gives us an idea of how much we're going to have to remediate. Has this stuff spread through the air? Is it a really nasty form of mold, or is it something that if we don't get 100% of it, we can live with? So in most cases, what I'm recommending to people is have it tested first, then call a restoration firm who will come in and manage the water, get everything cleaned up. Then we've got to talk to the basement people about how to not have this happen again. And then we have to rebuild it, hopefully with materials that are more resistant to getting wet.
And mold can happen very quickly, can't it?
They generally will tell you that the first 48 hours is very critical. The problem that we have in many of our basements is you've had drywall in that basement for 20 years, and as I said, that wall is vapor permeable. So there's already some mold there. So all it has to do is get a little bit wetter and for the humidity to get a little bit higher, and we get just absolutely beautiful blossoms.
Gorgeous. We don't talk about that in Garden Talk, that's for sure. Let's go to the phones. We've got John in Spooner with a question. Go ahead, John.
Hi. Perfect topic for me. I live in a house in Baronet, Wisconsin. It's 100-year-old. This year it turned 100. Solid brick house. It's the first floor is 3/4 of brick thick. Second one is 2. The third one is 1. There isn't a wooden stud in this house. But the basement is always, always wet. In fact, so much that there's cracks in the old floor.
Mm-hmm.
I could jump on the floor next to some of these cracks and water will
water shoots up. Mm-hmm.
I've been wanting to put in a sump pump, but I'm almost afraid to remove the water under the house. Everybody that I know of in Baronet that has a basement has a wet basement.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's solid clay all the way to Hades.
Right.
So when you dig a hole, you build your house in it or your basement, and the water just runs down the side where you've made the hole,
mm-hmm.
and you've created a swimming pool.
Right. And Don, your basement is not at all finished, is it?
John?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, is your basement finished at all?
No.
Okay, wonderful. And what are the basement walls also brick, or are they stone or concrete block?
They're brick, which was foolish in the first place. You never put brick below grade.
People did, though. Yeah, people did. I've seen some 100-and-some-year-old brick that actually didn't look all that bad. Part of it depends on how heavily they were fired. But, yes, the brick certainly are a problem. Yeah, this is a very difficult question because we do have clay soils. Your clay soils are probably not expansive clay. You know, you're down in Texas, we've got clay soils, but you put some water on it, doubles in size. So that, I think in your area in Baroneta, that doesn't happen. So I think you can probably safely dewater. So you could at least get the floor dry. If you talk to a basement specialist, they'd come in and they might do like a perimeter cut. And then they may say, we need to do two cuts across the middle as well. So in other words, it sort of looks like a figure eight or a double figure eight or something. So that as the water comes up, they can intercept it. Although they may say, you know, we'll just do the perimeter and I think it'll be fine. And they may be correct. I don't think that that will cause shifting or movement in your brick wall. The nice thing about brick is that it's very forgiving. Your brick was laid up with lime-based mortar, not Portland cement, which is not forgiving. So even if it moves a little bit, you should not really have a problem with it. Now, the wall itself, old brick mass walls, if they're built right, would have two or three courses of brick, a one-inch airspace, and another course of brick. So that actually they were a rain screen. The water would go through that first course of brick, but then it flowed down through that hollow, come out at the bottom, and never soak through the rest of it. But that was more commercial building, because people with commercial buildings had more money. So yours is probably just a regular mass wall. And sealing brick is always a bad proposition. I have never found a sealer that works. What sort of overhangs do you have on the house up there?
I believe it's just a 12-inch eaves there.
Okay. I think next time you re-roof, I would increase the size of those overhangs if you can. We need to think about overhangs as umbrellas because they really do save at least part of the wall from getting wet. Now, of course, you get a driving rain out of the south, everything's going to get wet anyway. But if we average it all out, the wider the overhang on your house, the less water problems you're going to have as far as water actually getting into the walls. Does that help?
Yeah, I totally understand that. I was in home building and remodeling for many, many years. Unfortunately, I just put a new roof on the house two years ago, so it's good. Mm-hmm. It should outlive me.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not going to be changing anything up on the roof.
Yeah, sounds like the dewatering, water collection and dewatering sounds like the best thing you can do at this point.
Well, right. Good luck with that, John. Not an easy situation for sure. Let's go to Karen next. She's in Eau Claire. Go ahead, Karen.
Hi. I have a spot in my basement, probably like maybe 2 feet by 3 feet, that always is wet. Sometimes there's more water. Sometimes there's like just, it's just damp.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I don't see any water lines coming down the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming it's coming up from the floor and it's not by a pipe. You know, there's nothing there that would be like leaking kind mm-hmm. of a pipe or anything. And I just, is there something I can put on that to seal that spot?
No. They will tell you there is, but what it does is it seals water from going downward. It doesn't seal water or water vapor from going upwards. So you put on the seal and it'll just all blister. So, well, as I said earlier, we can't see into the soil to see what's there for drainage. I remember working on a house on the east side of Madison, and we had to dig up the whole foundation to dewater it, and we had a heavy rainstorm. And there was a circle of sand in the side of the excavation. Water shot out of that like a fire hose. There was actually an underground stream that they had built this house and intercepted this underground stream. So they had massive quantities of water flowing downhill through this pipe of sand. So you may have some weird little thing like that. So you could have somebody come in and saw cut the floor with a concrete saw, see what you've got for soil. If there is sand there, take it out, put in some bentonite clay, put in some EPDM membrane, re-pour the concrete. That area, I can guarantee, will stop leaking. Now, it may leak 2 feet away from that, but at least you'll have a little bit more idea as to what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good luck, Karen. Let us know how that works out for you. If you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. Our lines are open. Or if you want, you can send us an email as long as it's not too detailed, and that's talk@WPR.org. We did get an email from Sierra. They are buying their first home. It's a 1946 home, and the home inspection didn't show any signs of seepage. The basement has 2 floor drains and no sump pump. They want to finish one room and install carpet. Can they cap one of the 2 floor drains, and what's the best way to do this?
Yes, you can cap a floor drain. You're going to have to talk to a plumbing contractor to see which is the uphill, which is a downhill floor drain. There's also going to be a vent someplace in the basement. Both floor drains may be vented through that single vent. So you're going to have to talk to a licensed plumber about how exactly to do that.
And as far as the carpet goes in one of the rooms?
No carpet.
There's so many alternatives, Sierra. Just look.
There really are. Yeah. LVT really is, I think, a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's vinyl. Nothing can really grow on it.
Right.
And when it snaps together, you can unsnap it and see what's going on. So I'm really big on it. I think it has given us a low-cost alternative to the very expensive ceramic that I'm always suggesting to people.
And there are always rugs to make things cozy. It's a lot easier to pull out a area rug than it is for full
That's
carpet.
Right.
So, yeah. So we were talking about roofs a little bit ago, and that's another place for water to come in, obviously. What should we be looking for after all of this rain? Is it a good time to go up in the base or the attic and see what's going on?
Yeah, everybody should look in their attic at least once a year.
Okay.
Generally, when we get roof leaks, it's always in the area that we can't see it in the attic because the water flows down the roof till it gets near the edge. And that's where it's concentrated, and that's where the nail hole is or the busted shingle, and that's what we can't see from the attic. But if we have things like spots on ceilings in the rooms below, then it gives us an idea that something is going on up there. So it is good to go up and take some sort of look. And there are people that inspect roofs and do a very good job of it. Depending upon the age of your roof, any roof that is more than 20 years old, unless it's a very high-end laminated roof with the type they have either 40-year, 50-year, or lifetime warranties, once that roof is 20-some years old, or once other roofs are 20-some years old, it's always good to do an inspection of it.
Okay. Thanks very much for that email. Let's go to Annie and Dalton. Go ahead, Annie. What's your question?
Well, we bought my grandparents' house. They built this back in 1947, Grandpa and his buddies, and they did a really good job. But the drywall they used is kind of strange. Where it's cut through the wall for receptacles, it's as thick as standard drywall, but it's like a layered fiber sort of product.
Right. Fiberboard.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Okay. And it had wallpaper over it, which over the years has been painted over by myself and others. And I'm just, it's cracking. That paper layer, it starts to, you can see the little cracks starting, and then it cracks through the paint layer itself, and then I can peel sheets off.
Sure.
How to fix that?
Oh, it's actually fairly easy. So that, the early 1940s, I used to love inspecting houses from 46, 47, 48. You saw the strangest things. and not 2x4 studs, but 2x3s. because wood was scarce.
Oh, that makes
sense. Palletized roof systems, where they were actually were modular in 1946, because people were coming out of the military with all of these interesting engineering skills, and they were applying them to houses. And this fiberboard was a good substitute for the pre-war material, which was, my grandfather called it lath board. It was basically a 16-inch or 18-inch by 2 foot, or at most 3 foot, section of 3/8-inch thick calcium sulfate and paper. And it sort of worked for a few years, but on the ceilings, when you do a home inspection, you'd walk in and you'd see all these dimples in the ceiling and lines. You go, oh, we've got old-fashioned lath board there. So they came out of the war and they said, well, we've got this wonderful high-density fiberboard, and we can use it just like drywall. And indeed, you can. But what it probably takes at this point is to talk to a real plasterer, not a drywaller, but a plasterer. So if we were in Madison, I'd have you call a friend of mine, David, whose last name I won't use, and he would come in and say, look, we're going to strip off what we can. We are going to glue mesh over this whole thing so there'll be no cracks. Then we're going to put on two layers of plaster that'll only be 1/8 inch thick, and it's going to look absolutely brand new, and it will never crack. So see if you can find someone in your area who does thin coat plastering and knows how to do mesh, and can actually restore this old fiberboard so that you get another 80 years out of it.
And plaster walls look beautiful.
They do.
They are really gorgeous. Okay, thanks, Annie, for that call. Stephen Shano, you are next.
Yeah, hey, our son's got an old, it's a 100-year-old house that has a fieldstone foundation under it. It's got a 14-12 pitch roof, so the water comes off of that like a waterfall.
Right.
And there were gutters, but the gutters started to grow greenhouse vegetables and, you know, trees and other. So they rotted out. Probably going to replace those. Anyhow, we had an old fieldstone foundation house as well, and I was thinking of doing the same. It had a mansard roof, same issue, with a gutter system that actually ran into the cistern.
Right.
So the gutters were designed to run to, you know, a waterfall, mm-hmm. Which was right next to the foundation. So anyhow, needless to say, lots of moisture pooling when there's downpours and so forth. Mm-hmm. My idea, and I wanted to see what you thought about this, the biggest problem is that they painted the walls with a waterproof paint type mm-hmm. stuff. So now all the mortar joints are deteriorating and
right.
so forth.
Right.
Got to deal with that. But, there's nothing you can do once it's been painted, you know, unfortunately. But what I was thinking of doing is taking that closed cell foam board that they use to insulate the outer walls of foundations mm-hmm. and just cutting into like 2 foot sheets or 3 foot wide sheets, mm-hmm. dig down along the foundation. And bury it, you know, like 12 inches below grade, or, you know, just deep enough so that you can have like a ground cover planting on top of it. Mm-hmm. But actually have it pitched like with a 5-degree, 10-degree pitch towards the outside. So mm-hmm. when water pours off the roof, it goes down to the ground, hits that foam board, and then runs farther out away from the foundation. Because otherwise the soil has good drainage. We have mm-hmm. a lot of sandy soil. That drains pretty well.
Right. You know? We just need to get it away from the foundation so it doesn't go straight down and then into the basement.
And find a crack in the foundation wall someplace, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. What do you think of that?
Well, I actually advised somebody in Madison to do that about a week ago because they had a situation with a house actually has a round roof on it, and all the water is collecting in certain areas, and there's just no way of really controlling it with the gutters because the area is too small to collect it. So what we talked about is basically removing soil. We were going to use EPDM membrane and bury that in the soil, pitched away from the house, and we had a bunch of other things we're going to do as well. But yes, that indeed can help. As far as the stone foundation itself, that paint is all eventually going to fall off because we get vapor pressure on the other side. And as it falls off, just repair the mortar joints. Use 6 parts sand, 2 parts lime. I usually use and not quick lime, but hydrated lime. And then I use a white Portland cement, as another one part. So you got a nine-part mix, six sand, two lime, one cement. This sticks really well. Then you can throw in it a bonding agent. So Elmer's makes Elmer's bonding concrete bonder, Acryl 60, Acryl 70. You can pick it up at most hardware stores or builders' places. And this is a real easy mortar to use. You work on it for an hour or two, and you'll really be proud of how it looks. But it's a way of continuously patching the wall. It helps the wall structurally because it helps replace the calcium that's been washed up by soil acids. And you can keep that basement in pretty good shape that way. So don't give up on the foundation. And your outside idea sounds pretty good.
Okay, great. Thanks, Steve. Roger in Wanakee, what can we help you with?
Hello. I destroyed my basement wall by taking off my eaves troughs on the outside of the house. And we had a rain event in the wintertime. It rained like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it froze.
Yep.
Water went down along the wall and started to collapse the inside brick mortar wall.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have cracks in the inside of the wall. What I did is I went outside and I got an excavating equipment and I dug around the wall, around my gas pipe and stuff, went down a couple feet and put in drain tile going down the hill. So mm-hmm. if water gets in there again, it's going to go out. And then I put clay on top of it for a cap along the outside of the wall. I didn't go with bentonite paneling, which probably would have been the way to do it. But now I have a wall on the inside. I don't think I'm going to have a problem with collapsing the wall again with that mm-hmm. unique rain event and the terrible below zero freezing. But what do I do with the cracks that are in the very well-constructed brick wall on the inside of the basement? It's pushed in a little mm-hmm. bit much.
Now, Ryan, is this actual brick or is it concrete block?
It's concrete block.
Concrete block. Okay. That makes life easier. So what's happened is we've blown out a mortar joint, and that mortar joint no longer has tension tensile strength. So if something may happen, and it may move in the future. Do you know, if you put a 5-foot level on it, do you know how far out of plumb it has been moved?
No, but not much.
Okay, good. If it's less than a half inch, it's very fixable. Now, there is a company, I'm trying to remember the right name. The first part's Gorilla. And I think it's called Gorilla Ties or Gorilla Columns. And what they have is basically it's a homeowner installable system of what we call flexural members. And we used to design this all the time, except we had to make them up out of steel and things. And what this Gorilla company has done is they've got it all pre-engineered, and you can ask them for the professional engineer stamped information on it. And they have a system where you attach this to the floor with sort of an L bracket and a couple of bolts you drill to the concrete, and then you attach it to the joists. And if the joists are running the wrong direction, they got blocking instructions. And then these are actually tightenable. And if you tighten it over time, you may find that if you're only out a quarter inch or so, that you actually can close up that crack. Plus, you've got these flexural members, so if we have something ever happens again, they now are going to have the tension strength to resist that wall moving. So take a look at it. I'm working on a house design right now with them, and I have not used them before, so read it real carefully. I just got the engineering sheets from them yesterday. But it looks like what we always used to custom design as steel flexural members, except now they're being mass produced because so many people with concrete block foundations have had minor movement.
Okay. Well, I looked up Gorilla Ties, and I think that probably is it, although there are ties out there with gorillas on them in case anybody wants one. So thank you so much, Roger. Appreciate that call. We're talking with John Freiberger. He's a registered home inspector. If you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hope you can join us tomorrow on Garden Talk. You'll learn more about creating a bird-friendly garden and then what you should know about the ground cover revolution. That's tomorrow starting at 11. Hope you can join us. Right now, we are getting a lot of calls on water and where it's not supposed to be. Let's go to Cassandra in Madison. Hey, Cassandra, what's up?
Hi, I live in an old house in Madison, Wisconsin, 110 years old. And the basement is, I guess, poured concrete, but like a really not a high quality concrete. And somebody put a parge coat over it, and that is now flaking off. So I'm getting a lot of spalling. Mm-hmm. And then also the concrete underneath is just really like crumbly, dry, and deteriorating. Mm-hmm. Is there something I can do to people have said it's not a structural issue, but it's annoying. I would like to have it stop shedding dust everywhere.
Sure. Yeah. Old concrete was usually with mined aggregate. So a lot of times it's, you know, pebbles and things from old stream beds. You know, it was before we were crushing limestone. And what one of the things that makes modern concrete so strong is the crushed limestone. We got all this extra calcium carbonate that your walls probably don't have. And your walls may actually be part lime and part Portland. In fact, they could be all lime binder. So they're rather delicate, but they have tremendous compressive strength. You could probably have a six-story house on top of those foundations and be just fine. But the problem that we get is lateral pressure. At some point, they're going to start breaking up. I'm working on a couple of those right now. Whatever they put over the wall, probably like the paint that was on the other gentleman's stone foundation, probably did a little bit of damage because it was holding moisture inside. You can reparge coat, but if you reparge coat, I would like you to use that lime-based mortar, which in your case can be lime-based plaster. You just mix the consistency a little bit different so that it can actually breathe. And again, this can actually be a do-it-yourselfer. So 6 parts sand, 2 parts lime, 1 part Portland cement. I like white Portland just because it looks prettier. And then Acryl 60, Acryl 70, Elmer, some sort of bonding agent. And you can put it on with a trowel. You can even put it on with a heavy brush. We used to call them beaver brushes. I'm not sure what they call them now, but there is a heavy bristle brush that you could put it on. So I would try that. It might be one of these things where every 2 or 3 years you go, well, it's middle of January. I can't do any gardening. I think I'll go down and fix the basement again. But you should be able to keep it up. And certainly that parge coat is going to take care of this dirt and dust. You're applying calcium, and calcium migrates all the time, right? Old brick walls can be self-healing. They will crack, and then you come back 2 years later, and the crack's gone. Because that calcium is just like our bones. That calcium has moved and actually has healed. So I think what you have is something that is probably quite maintainable, and you may come up with a whole new skill set that you can tell your friends about at parties.
Gee, don't talk to me, Cassandra, at a party. Thank you very much for that call. Let's go to Linda in Madison. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I have a 1977 ranch with a poured concrete floor and walls in the basement. It's not finished. Mm-hmm. And maybe I've been here for 15 years and twice now, about 4 feet up, I'm assuming there's a deteriorated rebar. There's a little hole, it's about a half an inch, mm-hmm. and I'll get maybe 2 cups of water out of
there.
Sure. And again, it's a super dry basement. Mm-hmm. Is it worth it to plug that hole, or is that just going to displace the water?
No, go ahead and plug it. What that is a snap tie hole. So your house is new enough that they use large plywood forms. Unlike the really old houses like Cassandra's, they actually nailed wood together to make forms, and then they reused it as the floorboards. But yours had pre-made forms, and of course, when you poured the concrete in, they wanted to move outward. So they had ties that were made of iron or steel that went through the wall, and there was a clip on the outside and a clip on the inside of the basement. And then when they removed the forms, they snapped them off. They literally hit them with a hammer, and they snapped off. If it's a wet area, over time, those will simply rust out. So then you basically have a hole in your wall. So put some water plug in it, see what happens. It may never leak again.
Wonderful. That's good news. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Linda. Let's go next to Edward in Oshkosh. Go ahead, Edward.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. So my wife and I just bought a house, and it's also a 70s poured concrete basement. The previous owner had just glued wood paneling to the basement walls. Mm-hmm. And as I removed that paneling, because I don't like the look of wood paneling anyway, we found a crack in the concrete that the paneling was hiding, and we are getting a little, in the heavy rains, we are getting a little bit of water through that crack.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, they did try to fix it. There's just scabbed concrete over the top
right.
of it. So I'm curious about how best to fix that crack. And I know that part of the problem is on the west wall where this crack is, we have a sidewalk right up next to the foundation. Mm-hmm. And as the grading has settled, that sidewalk is now pitched toward the house.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nowhere for the water to run
right.
Except up against that wall. So the plan is to remove that sidewalk, fix the grading, but I still have this crack, which we are getting water
sure.
through, and I want to fix that up so that we're sealed there.
Okay. Well, you're going to have a foundation expert someplace in the Oshkosh area you could call, and you're going to ask him about epoxy injection. And he's going to look at your crack, Edward, and he's going to say, well, I need to drill 8 holes here, and then I'm going to inject epoxy, and it's going to be $923.17 with a sales tax. And that will fix it not just against water but structurally. And what this probably is, Edward, is simply a shrinkage crack. Is concrete shrinks unless it's very expensive, you know, multi-bag, you know, specialized concrete. All concrete shrinks. Every basement in Madison has a crack in the concrete wall someplace, unless it was very specialized. So you can simply fix them with the epoxy injection, which isn't all that expensive because now basement repair has become competitively priced. As far as that sidewalk that's up there, you might talk to somebody who does what's called foam jacking. Now, in the old days, we mud jacked, right? We put mud under the sidewalk, and of course it was mud, so it washed out. So nowadays, what we use is closed cell foam. And we can develop tremendous pressure, we can lift it up, and then we have closed cell foam instead of mud under the sidewalk. So that might be less expensive than tearing out that concrete and redoing it.
I like that idea. Good luck, Edward. Thanks for calling. Dawn in Wausau, what can we help you with?
So I have a follow-up to a call-in last time that you were on the show in which I was experiencing water intrusion above windows, above and below some windows.
Mm-hmm.
So since that time, I've had about 8 to 10 different contractors out, and nobody can seem to figure it out. So the quick summary of the home is it's a one-story home built in the 50s. The moisture intrusion is happening on a gable end
mm-hmm.
with, unfortunately, no overhangs.
Right.
And now, these are plaster walls. The windows are about 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It has vinyl siding. After looking behind it, it has polar fan fold wrap with nothing behind it before the shiplap.
Mm-hmm.
So about 15 years ago, before I bought the house, the gable vents were sided over.
Mm-hmm.
With the vinyl ridge vent added. So you have siding over the gable vents, you have a freeze board, then you have vinyl shake, another freeze board, and the siding. There are no drip caps that I'm able to find. So the only thing that I found that anyone is willing to do is basically reside the house.
Oh,
rip
dear.
It off, see what's going on, and reside the house. So like I said, I've done 8 to 10 contractors, and it's been a saga. So I just wanted to call and find out what your thoughts were.
What kind of prices are you getting for residing the house? Are they pretty high?
About $30,000 on an 800-square-foot home.
Okay. Yeah, that's a lot. Well, most likely what we have here is a deficient weather-resistant barrier. So nowadays, I'm sure Tyvek is, it's made by DuPont, and there are other ones. Kimberly-Clark makes one called Block-It. There are all kinds of different types of weather-resistant barriers. The question on your house is, besides the window, do we have other issues? Is there basically no weather-resistant barrier on the house? And if so, yeah, we're seeing the leaks at the windows. We might not be seeing the leaks that are coming through the walls. So I think what I'm going to suggest you do is to get a disinterested party in there who doesn't want to sell you anything, and that's going to be a home inspector. And again, until we update the Wisconsin Association of Home Inspectors website so it says what the specialties are, which is something I'm working on right now, you're going to have to make some calls. And you're going to have to call Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones and say, what do you know about weather-resistant barriers? And they can and say, look, you can take some siding off if you have to figure this out. But find someone who has that expertise, who is a home inspector, who you can hire for their usual hourly rate to come in and tell you what's really going on. And the home inspector may say, I'm sorry, we really need to take all the siding out and wrap this entire house. Or he may say, you know, we can work around these windows, pull the siding off, put it back on. And part of it is also going to be based upon the grade of the siding. There's some real cheap stuff out there, and you can't really take it off because it breaks. And then there's some good stuff that's still highly pliable and flexible, and you can reuse it. So I think you're going to need to find a home inspector that has the skill set that you need to really give you some good advice. And then based upon that, you can talk to the contractors with some assurance.
Okay. Thanks, Don, for keeping us updated on that one. We'll look forward to hearing from you in a couple more months. Rick in Madison, what can we help you with?
Yes. Hi. I have a 62-year-old raised ranch. It has water heat, and I believe that after it was originally built, the air conditioning was added.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 4 years ago, it was time to replace the air conditioning. There's a condenser outside and a heat exchanger in the attic, mm-hmm. and from there, it has a drain that goes through the roof and into the eaves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, last winter, evidently, the water in the drain trap froze and cracked the drain.
Mm-hmm.
So when we turned the air on this summer, the water just started draining into our attic.
Right.
And caused about $1,000 worth of damage. And the air conditioning company charged $900 to come out and fix the trap, but they left it just the way it was before.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we do? What's our options?
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions, Rick. So this is located in an attic. Is that attic condition space, or is the insulation at the ceiling attic floor level?
The insulation is at the just above our ceiling.
Right. Okay. So in other words, it is in what we call an unconditioned space. That's always
right.
A bad idea. It probably means the ducts are running across the attic floor, and they probably got a little bit of plastic insulated wrap on them, but not much. And that
right.
is a heat that is heat loss problems in the winter. The drain should have been run through the house to the basement, and the easiest thing is usually to find where the main vent pipe comes up from the bathroom, because you can usually get a half-inch tube or 3/8-inch tube or whatever down through there. If you have to go across the attic, you put what's called a condensate pump up there, where it actually pumps the water along. The other thing I've had people do is to surround the air handler in the attic with basically an insulated wall, so that it is the same temperature in the winter as the rest of the house. You take off the insulation that's under it, you build a wall around it with an insulated hatch so you can get to it, and that way things don't freeze and you don't have all that deterioration. Does that make sense to you, Rick?
Yeah, that does make sense to me. But now, what does the air conditioning company, what responsibility do they have for having either done a poor design or a poor installation or both?
Not an attorney.
Okay.
Yeah, it's generally in Wisconsin, there's what's called a 1-year warranty. So it goes wrong within a year, people are expected to fix it. There's also 5 or 6 year workmanship warranties, and that ends up being a long argument. And it's probably best not to go down that path. Let's just fix it. We're going to improve the efficiency of the system because we won't have as much heat loss, right? So you're going to make that $900 back over the next 6 winters anyway.
Okay. Well, thank you for that question, Rick. And we're going to be back after a little bit of news. Hope you can stay with us. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for being with us today. And we're talking about home improvement with our regular guest, John Freiberger. He's a Wisconsin registered home inspector, and his firm, Freiberger & Associates, is based in Fitchburg. Do you need help with a home improvement project? Will you go join the conversation? Full lines right now, but I'll give you the call, the number to jot down, 800-642-1234. And you can always send us an email, as long as it's not too detailed, and that's talk@WPR.org. So let's go right to the phones. We've had a couple people being very patient and waiting. Mike in Minocqua, it's your turn.
Hi, how you doing? I have a cottage up in the North Woods in Minocqua that is a wooden frame, and I've had it for about 27 years, and only once during that time did I have a breach where sand and water broke through, and it was after lots of heavy rains and also before I had gutter. Before I had gutters. I was just wondering, what we did after that is we reinforced it with more wood. And I was just wondering how you felt about that, if you have any opinion on these wooden frame houses. Like I said, since we've put in the gutters, it's been pretty good.
Right.
And reinforced it a little bit.
Yeah, and Mike, what you're talking about is basically a wooden foundation system rather than poured concrete or concrete block, right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I have seen several of those. I have worked on a couple that had failed massively. And it was the same thing. It was sandy soil. You figure it would be well drained, but it wasn't. And a couple of them had hove in at the bottom and were really a bit of a mess. So reinforcing it is about all you can do. I'm sure you're using treated wood. And the problem is you've got to somehow hold the bottom of that tight. You've got to get somehow in the soil or something so that it can't be shoved sideways. Now, at the top, you can always attach it to your floor joists because the sand and water is not going to shove the whole house over. So the trick is always what you have at the bottom. Do you have a concrete floor poured inside, or is it just a sand floor?
Yes.
It's a concrete floor?
No, it's a concrete floor.
Okay. Well, then I think you can probably treat it that way. Now, a little earlier in the program, we mentioned these Gorilla ties. And you may want to just go to that website. Again, I haven't used these yet. I'm looking at them right now, but they do supply the engineering and things. But basically, this is a steel flexural member that you bolt into an L angle on the floor, attach to your joists, and they then, you then adjust them with a screw, and they go into tension to hold the wall. That might be a little bit more reliable. I mean, without analyzing the unbalanced fill and the soil types and everything else, it's hard to say exactly what's right. But I would say either take a look at doing this with treated wood timbers. Got to remember that wood bends. You have to have some really thick wood before it doesn't bend, like 6 inches. So if we're just using, 2x4s, even with a 3.5 inch against the wall, we're still going to get some bending. So take a look at steel flexural members, and there may be a company besides Gorilla Ties that does it as well. I just happen to be working with them on something right now. But you're certainly, your program is correct. Let's go ahead and get this thing stabilized so it doesn't move further. If it is really bad, you can take out the one section and you can redo it, basically building it by hand to make sure that's well tied in. The problem is if you ever decide to sell the cottage, you've got to be really careful with your disclosures.
Okay, thank you, Mike. John in Holcomb, thank you for staying with us. What's your question?
I don't know if I've ever had a more timely situation listening to your show. I'm clearing out and cleaning out my garage. It's on a slab, prepping it for, I'm going to degrease and etch it and then put some epoxy down. When the house was built 33 years ago, they put a drain in the middle of the garage floor, and then there's a sump over on the side. We're not connected. It's in the woods here, so it's not connected to any sewer or anything.
Sure.
And it has a sand bottom on it, and it's a black corrugated plastic, about 22 inches across and about the same deep. Never had a problem with it. Check it every year. It's always dry. And this year, I noticed a smell coming out. And as I'm prepping the floor here, I pop the cover off, and I notice that there has been a hole chewed in it, in the top, and it's full of dead mice and water. So it's I have I'm assuming the water has come up because of all the water we've had.
Yeah.
Over this past year. I'm just wondering, is there anything that I can do to prevent this in the future? I don't want to just dump, you know, EasyCrete or something in there and, you know, have that smell. I don't want to completely waterproof it. I don't want the thing popping out of the ground if it,
hydrostatic head pressure. Is there any slope, John, to your lawn so that you could extend the drain from that garage floor so it actually drained to daylight someplace so we could get rid of the pit? There isn't.
No, and the thing is, the problem or the situation of it is that we don't even, it's never been, had any moisture in it because we don't park cars. There's no snow melting or anything. It's strictly storage. I could fill it in, I guess, with sand. But
my concern is that you have got moisture in there because you say there's sand on the bottom. My guess is if you dig through that sand, you're going to find actually it's got a plastic bottom. And there's probably holes in that bottom to let hydrostatic pressure come into the sump and water to drain out. And you'll probably find that that thing has been cycling water. Now, that may not make a difference because of where the garage floor is. It could be you've got, you know, hydrostatic head pressure a foot under the garage, but that doesn't affect the garage floor if it's a foot underneath. So in that case, you could, you could fill it in. I wish there was a different solution because now we've got a slope towards a garage drain that's not going to drain anywhere. So that becomes an issue.
I could throw sand in it to cover it up, but I don't know what that would.
Yeah, but what happens to the water in the garage? I mean, the other thing you could do is clean it out, put a sump pump in there in the summer, take it out in the winter so it doesn't freeze. So if we do get a bunch of water in there in the summer, at least it's going to pump it out. But the pump won't be broken by frost damage in the winter.
Okay. Thanks, John. Appreciate that call. And good luck with those cleaning that out. Ew. Sounds like a great surprise, right? Jeff in Berlin, how can we help you? Jeff?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, Jeff. Yeah.
We recently purchased a house built approximately 1865. So my two questions are, one, several of the floors have a drop of almost 2 inches over 15 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And how would one begin to even think about heating a house that was that old? Or not heating, but insulating.
Yeah, very good questions. Houses of that period, mine is built in 1861, so I got 4 years on you, were very lightweight. My second floor had 2x6s running something like 15 feet. If you got roller skates on, you cannot leave the master bedroom.
You tried that, John?
It's all uphill to the door. So the lightweight has simply caused these old houses to deflect. Now, I've done a lot of work on my house to try to strengthen the floor. The house is brace framed, which is a very odd technical way of doing timber framing. And if you're worried about the floors, that's something where you have a house plan drawn, you analyze it, and you figure out where you can add wood. Outside insulation is always difficult. Have you opened any walls, Jeff, to see what's inside?
We don't think there's much in the way of insulation there.
Well, there probably isn't. I did see one house fairly recently that was insulated with corn cobs. That probably actually worked pretty well. I have seen other houses where they actually have lath and plaster in the middle of the 2x4 studs to break it into two air spaces. So there's less than two inch air spaces, which gives you basically an R4 wall just due to dead air. The best way of working on these old houses, I believe, is to be able to insulate the wall with closed cell foam, because that gives you a vapor barrier as well as insulation. The problem with this house is if you put fiberglass or something or open cell foam into the wall, you are now going to have the first condensing surface being the backside of the exterior sheathing, which is nailed with iron or steel nails, which then will rust and the whole house will be destabilized because you have no headers over your windows, you have no headers over your doors. Unless you're brace frame, you've got no lateral bracing at all. So whatever you do in the interstitial space needs to be vapor impermeable. Now, what do you have on the outside, Jeff, for siding?
It looked like somebody at some point in time vinyl sided,
mm-hmm.
but it like there's a standard like lap siding. We believe
underneath the vinyl. Yeah. So the typical for that period, it could be lap plank or it could be a bevel siding, and so you do it with the vinyl siding. So somebody could come in from the outside, pop off vinyl siding, and then insulate the interstitial spaces with foam. But remember, once you do that, it's really hard to make changes to the electrical system. So if you have any old knob and tube or 1930s BX Greenfield cable or something like that, you want to make sure that all work that you're going to do in the outside wall is done before you foam it. But I would say that taking a look with a good foam contractor who really knows what they're doing with a closed cell foam would be the way to go.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. We've got a few emails we need to cover here. Mabel emailed us. She lives in Duluth, and in May they had Duluth, well, I guess it doesn't matter who, but they installed drainage on the outside wall of the middle laundry room and connected to a sump pump, and that was great. But the very back room is lower, and the water comes down the sidewalks and over tops the area by the basement steps. And when the water comes under the base... they cannot dig anywhere to put a drain in as there's a deck built over the steps. And there's no room for equipment to get back there. They are only about 4 or 5 feet between their home and the neighbor's home. They thought about building something to direct the water past the steps, but that is where they have to walk out of the basement area.
Oh, dear. Mabel obviously has a very complicated issue there and a very complicated set of elevations, buildings, etc. And I'm afraid I'm not going to try to answer it. I would suggest, Mabel, that you send me some photos to frei@chorus.net. Chorus is spelled like a group of singers, C-H-O-R-U-S, frei@chorus.net. Let me take a look at it, and with a little bit more knowledge, maybe I can make an intelligent comment. But at this point, I'm afraid I really can't.
It sounds like something really hard to describe and very unusual. So,
right.
Yeah. Okay. Jim in Madison, how can we help you?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I've got a not quite as old a home. It's 1903. It was built. It's a stone and poured 2-foot foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And the whatever material, concrete that held it together is sloughing off.
Mm-hmm.
Is there, what do I do to stop that?
Okay, now, Jim, is it coming off from between the stones or coming off the concrete or coming off both?
Between the stones.
Okay. I spoke a little bit earlier about a really nice mix that you can either have a mason do in the winter to fix up those walls. You're looking at a 6-2-1 mix of six-part mason sand. I will use a coarser sand if I've got pretty big gaps in the stone rather than a thin mason sand. And then 2 parts hydrated lime, 1 part Portland cement, and then a bonding agent, Acryl 60, Acryl 70, Elmer's, Bondo, whatever. And it is very easy to clean those joints out, vacuum them out. If they're really dry, you spray a little water. In the winter, you usually don't have to. And then you can tuck point those, and then you can make a paint out of the same mixture. You just add more water. And you can brush over it, and you'll be amazed at how nice it can look. There are a couple of restoration masons in Madison who would be very happy to do that for you in the middle of winter because they don't want to be outside. And since you are in Madison, if you would like a referral on that or have further questions or want me to email you the information, because I have written all this up, as I said earlier, frei@chorus.net. And I'd be happy to send you that information and any referrals that you would need, Jim.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jim. Appreciate that. We have an email from Kristen Menominee, and she's wondering if they should be concerned about asbestos when removing old carpet that has been glued down.
Old carpet. I have never heard of asbestos in carpet.
Would the glue have a problem?
Very, very unlikely. As we find asbestos in the vinyl asbestos tiles, which is a non-friable sort of asbestos, the old 9-inch by 9-inch tiles from the 40s and 50s. The other place we find nasty stuff is chrysotile asbestos in 1960s, 1970s vinyl sheet flooring. That stuff's the really bad stuff. And the old asbestos tile did have some glues that had asbestos in it. So if you have concerns, Chris, get a sample, send it to an asbestos lab. They will take a look at it and tell you whether it has any asbestos content or if it's asbestos-free. It's not going to cost much and good for peace of mind.
Yes, for sure. Would she take a piece of the carpet, a piece of some of the glue, and maybe something that's underneath it, or what does she send?
Just something that has a glue on it. If it comes off of the carpet, that's fine, or you may have to take a little scraper and get some off the floor and put it in a sealed bag. Be sure that you're wearing a M95 mask while you're doing it, gloves on your hand, and be careful.
Yeah.
Just in case. It
just
probably
in case.
Doesn't have it, but... You know, for $50 test fee for peace of mind is good.
Yeah, and even asbestos removal abatement isn't as expensive as it used to be, it seems like. Is that
no,
right?
There are more people in it because we are, the thing is, the 1950s, 1960s, 1970 houses are now of an age where nobody likes those bathrooms, nobody likes those kitchens, so a lot of that old asbestos-bearing flooring is being torn out.
Except for those who like mid-century modern and...
Right.
which we've talked about before. We had quite a few people interested in that. So let's go to another email here. Bill at Verona emailed. He said that in a previous show, we had talked about vinyl roofing was now a better choice for a flat-style roof than rubber roofing. Now, Bill has a rubber-roofed porch that needs replacement, but he can't find a roofer in Madison area who installs vinyl. Do you have any names for him?
yes, I do, but I'm not going to give it on the air. So I think go ahead and, again, email me at frei@chorus.net. I get 20, 30 emails after every single program, so don't feel bad about doing it. I always put time aside, but I'll be happy to give you a referral for somebody who can put that on for you.
Okay. Dana emailed us. They are renovating a bathroom. Now, one contractor says to never put sinks on an outside wall. Their kitchen sink works fine on the outside wall. Are there any specific guidelines to put one safely on that outside wall?
Yes, you want to make sure that you do not have air intrusion that could be bringing in cold air right through the insulation, and you want to have a very high R value per inch insulation. So once again, the closed cell spray foam is the best thing to put, but you make sure that's only outside the pipes. That is, the pipe is towards the heated space, the foam is towards the exterior. But let's say you've got R11 worth of fiberglass in there right now, and you're going to spray 2 inches of closed cell foam to have room for the pipe. You're going from R11 to R14, plus you're reducing the heat transfer via air movement. So you're going to be better off than you are now with the kitchen, kitchen or bathroom pipes being on the interior of the house.
Okay, I like that. That sounds like good news. You know, we were talking about flooding and whatnot earlier. What's your thoughts on flood insurance, John?
I don't know a lot about flood insurance. I believe that unless you're in a floodplain, it's sort of hard to get. Mm-hmm. But the problem is when we had, especially the 2018 floods, we had places in Mesomania where people were well outside of the floodplain and lost their houses. So I think... Yeah, you know, it's sort of like you inspect your house once a year. I talk to my insurance guy once a year, and I talk to him, ask him those questions. And those are the sorts of things where you go to a good insurance agent. They're going to know the history. They're going to check the maps. They're going to check the elevations. And if you can get flood insurance, they're going to say, is it worth it? Is it not worth it? So get a professional to advise you.
Okay, that makes total sense. And for those people who are listening who have not had any water in their basements, should they be doing some precautions or should they really not worry about it?
No, again, We really want to inspect our homes annually. We talked earlier that we want a half inch of pitch for 10 feet around the house. We want to have our gutters be the right size. A lot of people put gutters on 30 years ago and they were fine. They're no longer fine because we're getting 3.7, 4.8, 2 inch an hour rainfalls. So go outside when it's pouring. Take a look at your gutters. Mm-hmm. Is the water going to the downspouts? Do you need bigger gutters? Maybe you just need a bigger downspout. So analyze what's happening around your house, because with climate change, Wisconsin is getting wetter.
Yes, we are. So it's much better to be prepared, for sure. Now, those gutters we were talking about in the last couple minutes we have, I think we've talked about it before, but what are your thoughts on the covers that you can get for gutters?
Well, yes and no, depending upon the pitch of your roof. One of our callers said that I think they had a 14-12 roof. If he puts covers on his gutters, all the water is going to simply shoot over the top of it because of the speed. If you've got a ranch house with a 312, 412, the speed isn't that great, and the surface friction may be such that it can roll over the top, like the gutter helmet top, which has helmet type, which has a solid top. Other people just put screening down. The problem with the screening is you've got to do a lot of, the maple seeds are in there, the leaves are in there, or whatever the squirrels drop are in there. So it's a lot of additional maintenance. But if your house is gutters are 24 feet above the ground, well, maybe it makes a certain amount of sense. How many trees are around the house? What's the debris rate going to be? So you need to look at all of those things. The problem is if you call somebody who sells gutter covers, they're going to sell you gutter covers whether you need them or not.
Right.
So do a little bit of thinking. See how your gutters are working right now.
Mm-hmm. And how often should we go up and check them?
At least annually, but on my house, when I see the little baby maple trees, I go, well, it's been 6 months, but I've got to clean again because I've got giant silver maples around the place, plus pine trees, mm-hmm. and my gutters have to be cleaned 4 times a year or they simply don't work.
Yeah, I've got cedar trees, mm-hmm. and they've got little stuff all over the place, so I feel your pain. Thank you so much, John. We really, really appreciate you coming in and sharing all of your knowledge with us.
It has been a great pleasure.
Great, and we'll see you in a couple of months.
Very good.
All right. Disclosure here. By way of full disclosure, we should mention that Freiberger Consulting is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for being with us, but stay, because we're going to be talking about boating safety. Well, with Wisconsin's beautiful lakes and rivers, our state is really a boater's paradise. And today we're going to be talking about what you can do to stay safe while you're enjoying those natural resources. I'm Jill Nadeau. This is the Larry Mueller Show. And we're going to talk about boater safety today. Our guest is Lieutenant Darren Kuhn. He is with us for the rest of the show. He's the Boating Law Administrator in the Division of Public Safety and Resource Protection for the Wisconsin DNR. Whew, got to put that on your door, Darren.
Yeah, that's a mouthful.
It is. Have you taken a boating safety course? What tips did you take away from it? What do you want to do to make sure that your riders are safe in your boat? We always want you to join the conversation. Our number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So we were just talking earlier about water getting into our homes because we've had so much rain. So our lakes and streams were extremely high this year. Are they still in pretty high conditions?
There's some that are higher than others. A lot of our major river systems have gotten back down to normal water levels or close there too, just for the fact that it's been a little while since we have had rain. And a lot of those are controlled by some dams that can allow different variations of flow and get the water levels down. But it was definitely a dangerous situation there for a while, on especially the Mississippi, portions of the Wisconsin River, St. Croix River, and the Minnesota border. It was crazy for a while.
Yeah, I would imagine. So what are some of the dangers that come along with those high waters?
Well, especially with the river systems, With the high waters generally means a lot more runoff, which means a lot more current going through. And currents vary from throughout the water table. So if the current is where you're at, where your boat is, but if you go into the water underneath that, you might have some undertows and different current speeds. Also, you've got a lot of stuff, you know, debris that gets washed out. You know, a lot of this comes from storms. A lot of it comes from down branches, you know, maybe some rotten trees that broke off. Well, all that stuff floats down river, gets waterlogged, gets semi-submerged. So it doesn't go to the bottom. It just sort of hang in there. And you can either hit it with your boat, or especially nighttime operation becomes extremely dangerous on these flooded river systems where you just can't see stuff. So we've always tell people that if you're going to go out in those conditions, which isn't wise to begin with, slow down.
Oh,
you know, whether it's day or night, just slow down. Nothing is worth going that fast. Wisconsin River in particular, with all the sandbars that are there one day and not the next.
Right.
You really have to be cautious.
Mm-hmm. So legally, let's talk about some of the rules here. Who can operate a boat with a motor in Wisconsin?
Well, that is a loaded question. Is what that is. Generally speaking, somebody that's 12 years old that has had a boater safety class can do it.
Mm-hmm.
There are some exceptions to that rule of parental consent, parental supervision that applies to motor boats but doesn't apply to personal watercraft, the jet skis. And then with boater safety, anyone born after January 1st, 1989 is required to have a boater safety class before they can operate. So you've got that young crowd that can get boater safety right away. But boy, you do the math, 1989, that's a long time ago. That's a while. So a lot of people think that once they have their driver's license for a car, they can legally drive a boat without boater education, and that's just not the case. So anyone after January 1st, 1989 is required to have a boater safety class unless they're that juvenile age, that parental consent can go. But once you're, say, 18, that parental consent doesn't so much exist so much.
Sure, sure. So where do you get this training?
What I would suggest is go to our website and just type in the search box, boater education. We have a number of different options.
Mm-hmm.
There's some in-person classes that meet like once a week for like 3 weeks or for a couple hours at a time. Otherwise, we have a number of different online options, which you can link right to from our website that work at your own pace. Yeah, you know, if you want to take a break or you're done for the day, just come back to it wherever. And the website has all that information. But yeah, boater education, type it in the search box on the website, and that will take you right to the page.
And you're talking about the Wisconsin DNR website?
Wisconsin DNR, yep.
Okay. There's so much information in that website. It's ridiculous, really.
A lot of times I find when I go to the public-facing side of it is rather than trying to tab through, just type what you're looking for in the search bar. It's a lot easier because there is a ton of information out there.
There is, and the search bar actually works really well. I've done it myself, so not bad. What kind of things are people going to learn when they take these courses?
A lot of it is the rules of the road, if you will. What boat has the right of way as compared to which boat doesn't, and when it comes to crossing or passing, you know, we don't have lines on the waterway, so you got to know what the rules are as far as who is to stand on and who's got the right of way. Boat lights is a big one where all these boats come with them, but boaters don't understand that the red light means one thing and the green light means another thing, and they're on the specific sides of the boat for a particular reason. That's boater education. What to do in emergency situations. If you do have a capsizing incident, God forbid, or what you're taking on water, some stuff like that, basic safety, some first aid. By no means are you going to become an expert boater or a doctor by taking boater education. But if somebody gets a cut in the boat, some basic first aid on how to control that bleeding, how to keep yourself afloat if you do go overboard. And it's pretty much it. It's not a whole lot of rules based. There's, a law section, obviously, because you need to know what's legal and what's not. But it's more general boating knowledge so that you don't necessarily become that obstruction in the navigable waterways.
Right.
That, you know what you're doing or what you're supposed to be doing, and just safety messages of don't operate faster than you feel is safe, since there aren't really speed limits for the most part on our waterways. That it's just good safety messaging. And as far as becoming that expert boat operator, that only comes with stick time. You
sure. got
to get out and practice and drive a boat. And then by the end of winter, you got to relearn it again because you forgot.
Yeah, sure. And a lot of it, too, I would imagine, is things that you probably never even thought about before. But now you've taken the course and now you're aware of it.
There's some. I mean, the one thing that when I first took boater education long ago when I was a kid, they talked about locks and dams and mm-hmm. how to navigate through a lock and dam. Well, that meant nothing to me growing up in the central part of the state where they didn't exist. Well, now I come to Green Bay area and the Fox Valley where we have a ton of locks and dams. It's like, oh, now I see what you're talking about. But yeah, there's some stuff in there that might not necessarily apply to every area of the state as far as boating, but it's a good course, mm-hmm. and what's nice about it is if you were to vacation somewhere else within the country, Wisconsin Boater Education is honored in any other state in the country,
oh,
too. So if
okay.
if you say you want to vacation in Florida and rent a boat,
mm-hmm.
Florida is going to say, do you have boater education? And you're going to say, I do, from uh-huh. Wisconsin. And they're gonna, all right, we're good.
You get a certificate?
Yep.
Or
you'll
is
get
that the...
a card similar to like you would for hunter education or ATV safety. Any of those safety courses will come with a card
mm-hmm.
that you would just have to show if you were on vacation renting boat mm-hmm. somewhere.
Great. We got an email from Mark. He's wondering that if you put an electric trolling motor on your square stern canoe, does it become a motorboat?
It does. Our rules don't differentiate between a trolling motor or outboard motors or jet drives or gas or electric. It really is irrelevant. A motor is a motor is a motor. So as soon as you put on a motor on your canoe, I've seen them on paddle boats, putting motors on those then become motorboats, and then the motorboat rules apply as compared to the manual propelled registration, boat lights at night, multiple different things.
Sure. Is there a cost to the training, by the way?
It varies. Off the top of my head, I don't know exactly. I think it's $10 for the in-person and somewhere around $30 for the online. But there is a cost.
Mm-hmm.
It's just our boating education program is pretty much self-funded. So what we get into the education pot through the fees pays for the manual and the maintenance of the records and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, something to keep the boat floating, if you will. And everything costs a little bit.
It certainly does. Let's start out with some basic safety tips that really every boater should be aware of.
The one that I always make note of, for a number of reasons, is life jackets. 80% nationally of boating fatalities are drownings, life jacket related. Last season, we had 28 boating fatalities, 27 were drownings.
Mm.
We continue to see boats not wearing their life jacket, but not having them with them. There's not enough life jackets on board, which is really, honestly and bluntly, inexcusable. I mean, life jackets nowadays are readily available at any of your big box stores or your sports type stores. And they're not expensive. They're really not. You can buy a 3-pack for $30.
Mm-hmm.
And if it means saving a life, that it's worth it. We also have 100+ loaner life jacket stations around the state at different boat landings, where if you realize you have a guest that you don't have enough life jackets for that you weren't planning on, a lot of our boat landings will have loaner life jacket stations right there. Borrow one, use it for the day, and all we ask is you return it. And they're all over the state.
I had no clue. That's great.
Yeah.
So how do you find them?
A lot of them are advertised locally. If you went to the individual, if you type in, go to Google, whatever search engine,
mm-hmm.
type in your normal, your lake, and then we'll come up with a bunch of different links to that particular lake. And a lot of times on some of the forward facing sites, it will say loaner life jacket station right there. The counties generally will put that on the county park ones.
Okay.
Otherwise, we do have a map, but we have so many of these popping up, it's hard to keep updated because they pop up on a regular basis.
Sure.
And we fund them and partner with different organizations like scouting groups or different school NHS programs where they mm-hmm. need some volunteer hours, Kiwanis groups, stuff like that. So a lot of the times, if you're familiar with a lake, you'll see it right next to the launch. It'll be a brown box with some logos and a bunch of life jackets hanging now. Hanging off of it.
That's great. Yeah. And like you said, there's really no excuse now. It's really there. We're talking about boating safety with Lieutenant Darren Kuhn. He's boating law administrator in the Division of Public Safety and Rescue Protection for the Wisconsin DNR. Do you have some questions for him? Our lines are open, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hope you could join us again tomorrow for Garden Talk. We're going to be learning about creating a bird-friendly garden. And then we're also going to talk about ground cover. It's a revolution, apparently. That's tomorrow starting at 11. But right now we are talking about boater safety. So let's talk a little bit more about some of the basic safety tips. Once we get past those, what are they called? Personal flotation devices, PFDs, right?
Yep.
And they're so much more comfortable now than they used to be.
100%. I mean, growing up, I remember my parents, wear your life jacket, and we had these orange horse collars. They worked, and they still work, and they're still out there. But let's be honest, no one is going to wear them on a 90-degree day all day on the water.
Yeah.
But yeah, the options out there now are pretty much endless, where you have inflatable life jackets that are sort of like a horse collar where you just put them on and they'll automatically inflate if you go in the water. We have the ski vest types that are come in multitude of colors and fashion sense kind of thing. We have float coats that are, you know, maybe more for the fall or early spring activities where it's an insulated jacket with flotation. Even for the paddle sports now, we have ultimately what I refer to as a fanny pack. It buckles around your waist, and it's a Coast Guard certified life jacket PFD, where when it goes off, you literally just put it up over your neck and it doesn't get in the way of your paddling if you're standing up on your paddle board or cruising through the water with your kayak.
Mm-hmm.
So every color of the rainbow, every shape to fit any body size, and pretty much, you know, specialized for what activity you're doing. And not that it matters as much as the people, but for your pets, too.
Yes.
there's approved PFTs for pets. So if your friendly dog is coming with you and can't swim, there you go.
Even if they can swim, it's a good idea because they're dogs. you know, they're going to jump off. So what are the things that people tend to overlook when they're out there boating?
You know, a lot of times people will overlook the drinking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the same message that we preach with cars and trucks, highways, is don't drink and drive. Have a sober driver or a sober captain in the boating world. But what people overlook is how alcohol affects them when they're out in the environment, where what might be a safe limit for something sitting at a restaurant at dinner or at the kitchen table is not going to be the same as if you're out on the boat with the sun beating down on you all day, the wind, the wave action, all that helps with the alcohol impairment. And it's what might be safe at home isn't going to be safe on the water. And most of the time, it's not people that necessarily have alcohol problems that we're dealing with. It's the, well, I had a few beers at, you know, playing, tossing the football around on the sandbar, and it hit them a lot harder than it meant to. Nonetheless, you know, alcohol and boating, if you think about our reaction times and how we're used to driving a car, well, all the safety features that we have on our cars, we have seat belts and airbags and brakes, you know, and boats, you know, they don't have any of that. You know, there's no brakes, there's no airbags, there's no seat belts, there's no lines on the road to keep you where you're supposed to be going. So you really need all your faculties when you're operating a boat. It's a great sport. It's used for fishing and hunting and boating just for fun. But we really need to be responsible with that. And we really encourage people to leave the alcohol at the dock, leave it till you get home. Just be mindful of that because it's really affecting everyone. And then we take it a step further. A lot of times in Wisconsin, our boat operators trailer their boats. So if they've become impaired on the water and they safely make it back to the landing, well, now you're putting another user group in danger when you're trailering your boat back home. Mm-hmm. And alcohol impairment while pulling a trailer complicates things to that nth degree. So, I mean, it's really a domino effect that is so preventable of just leave it at home.
That's a great point. Because really, you don't think about that. You're like, well, I can, you know, drink this at when I'm sitting in the bar without a problem. Yeah, it's a little bit different.
It is.
In that same vein, Edward in the Northwoods emailed us asking, do alcohol-related tickets and fines connect to your driver's license like an OWI?
At this point in time, they do not. So because you don't need a driver's license to operate a boat, if you were to be arrested for an operating while intoxicated in the boat, it does not affect your driver's license. It does not go on your driving record. It does not go towards points or anything relating to the automobiles. Not to say in the future that might change, because there has been pushes for that in the past. But at this point in time, and there's nothing in current legislation or current proposals to change it, but it has been proposed in the past.
Do you think that would be an incentive if that happened for people to not drink on the lakes?
I think it would be an incentive. In some states, they do have that, and they have fewer incidents. But agreeing the fact that, you know, trying to affect a driver's license when you're not required to have a driver's license and the laws that we have in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, it definitely would be a deterrent.
Mm-hmm. But complicated to get there.
Kind of very complicated to get there.
So what kind of safety equipment should we have on a boat? And is it different for the type of boat that you have?
You know, some of it is different. So by law, any boat over 16 feet or greater is required to have a throwable type personal flotation device, your typical seat cushion or ring buoy. That's pretty standard across boating. Every boat is required to have a wearable type personal flotation device for everybody that's on board. Some of the safety features that we do overlook is our engine cutoff switches. And for people listening, what I'm talking about is that curly red cord that has a little hook that connects to your throttle assembly. What that's designed to do is if you pull that cord away from the throttle assembly, it turns off your motor. And what we're starting to see in Wisconsin, an uptick a little bit, but nationwide, we're starting to see an uptick of people falling or hitting a wave and getting taken away from the console. Well, if that's the case, you've got a boat continuing to go because it's not like a car where your foot's not on the gas. When you push the throttle handle forward, you're going. And if you're not driving, no one's driving, and we got a, you know, 10,000-pound rockets, you know, unoccupied going through the water. Mm-hmm. With that kill switch, it turns the motor off. It just comes to a gentle, calming stop. And if you fell overboard, you can get back to your boat, get back in it, and resume. If you just fell off the driver's seat, you clip back on and go. In Wisconsin, the only people that are required to wear that are personal watercraft, are jet ski operators. But every boat pretty much has one now. Mm-hmm. If you don't like the confines of the cord, there are commercial options out there for electronic, where if the fob gets wet or the fob breaks a Bluetooth signal, it will do the same thing. Those obviously are, you know, more expensive than just the cord that hooks in. But yeah, a lot of times you forget to unhook that cord and you turn off your motor accidentally, but it's not that big of a deal.
Yeah, just plug it right back in. I mean, exactly. Treadmills have them, for heaven's sake. So, yeah, you can hurt more people with a boat than you can a treadmill.
Well, and if you think about it, too, is you know, you get out there, and if you don't have an operator and the boat just keeps going, how are you going to stop it? I mean, mm-hmm. You're literally going to have somebody jump in from one boat to the other boat at whatever speed they're going. And it definitely becomes a dangerous situation, and even worse if you're on a you know, a populated lake like most of our Wisconsin lakes are. There's not a whole lot of lakefront property left vacant out there, and can just imagine the dangers if that went into a swim area or something.
Oh yes, definitely. That's a great idea. We did get an email from Amy in Milwaukee. She was talking about, we had talked about earlier about life jackets for dogs, which, mm-hmm. like we said, it's a good idea. But she's wondering, do human life jackets become out of date?
Human life jackets do not become out of date, but they can become unserviceable. And what I mean by that is over a lifetime, depending how the life jacket is treated, anything that's got cuts or tears in it is going to affect the serviceability of the life jacket. The straps, you know, if you leave them out in the environment, you know, all season, they just sit around strapped to the back of a boat seat or something, the straps could get rotten and that makes them inserviceable. Outgrowing them, their sizes. I mean, there's a number of different sizes for children, and then there's adult sizes at your typical large, extra large. So my recommendation would be just look at them, as your previous guest said, with the house inspections, look at them annually. Mm-hmm. Just take a look at the beginning of boating season. Make sure the straps are still good. Make sure that there aren't any tears that you didn't know about. Make sure they're the right size. As you know, as kids get bigger, their life jackets have to get bigger, just like their clothes and their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have an appropriate size life jacket for the person that it's for. And it could be 100 years old if you maintain them. Otherwise, if you don't really maintain them and they get all moldy and gross, they may become unserviceable. But ultimately, there's no expiration date.
And how do you know if it's too small or too big for you?
There'll be a label printed on the inside. It's either going to be printed on or it's going to be stitched on, one of the two. And it will have a chest size generally, and will generally have a weight of up to 90 pounds or triple XL chest size of this or mm-hmm. something along those lines. So there'll be a size on there that has a weight and a chest size that people should be able to figure that out.
Great. Yeah, I didn't realize that. I guess I never looked, but that makes total sense. I love that. So, and we were talking about safety equipment in the boat. Was that, we were talking about anything else that you would suggest?
Oh, we could go on for hours.
We've got 4 minutes.
Yeah, check your boat lights. Okay. A lot of times when we are working nights and we make contacts because of a boat light violation, they didn't check them before they went. They just relied on that they were going to work.
Mm-hmm.
I suggest, even if you're going out in the morning, just plug them in quick and just do a quick check to make sure they're there. That way you know, okay, well, I've got to be off the water by sunset. Because once sunset comes and your lights are required, it's a little late to figure out that they're not going to work now. They're not necessarily as reliable as your car headlights where you just assume they're going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And the excuse, well, I just turned them on and they didn't work, doesn't really mean that you get to stay fishing.
Right.
You got to come in.
Yeah. You're going to be accountable for that.
Correct.
So, do you have a lot of officers out there patrolling? Do we need more? Always.
Always. I mean, the work never stops.
Yeah.
And with our staff, we have about 200 or so field staff.
That's it for all of our...
For all of Wisconsin.
Whoa, you are definitely understaffed.
Well, and you mix in the fact that boating season is also state park season.
Yeah.
It's also ATV season and all of the different stuff that goes on with summer. Yeah, we could use another couple hundred, but I think we do a pretty good job with what we have.
Well, thank you for being out there for us. We do appreciate that. And thank you for coming in and sharing your wisdom with us.
Absolutely.
We've been talking with Lieutenant Darren Kuhn. He's Boating Law Administrator in the Division of Public Safety and Resource Protection for Wisconsin DNR. We want to thank our team today for helping us out. Our producers are Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm in for Larry Mueller this week. I'm the executive director. Please join us tomorrow on Garden Talk. We're going to be looking at creating bird-friendly gardens. I think we all like to see birds in our garden. And then we're going to talk about ground cover. It has become a long way in the past few years. We really appreciate you being with us today, and hopefully you can tune in again tomorrow. Thanks.